So today we're going to talk about the eye in special senses, and this information is going to begin in your course pack on page 126. Monday we're going to talk about the ear to complete our tour of the special senses. And so I thought instead of starting you with something about the eye, I'd start you with something about the brain. Do you see anything in this picture?
A dog.
See a dog in the middle?
I see a tree at the top.
There is a tree at the top, yeah. So right here's the dog, his ear, there's his face down, there's legs.
Okay.
See the dog? Okay.
Where's his face?
His face, we're looking kind of from behind, the face is going down. So it's not the eye that's doing this interpretation. What part of the brain is doing the interpretation? Association. Good. Yes. Yeah, so we're in the cerebrum. What lobe? Occipital. Good. Okay. So that's going to be part of our journey today, is to appreciate how the eye gets information to the occipital lobe, how we can, of course, receive that information and then translate that information. So what I'd like to do is start you by talking through the anatomy of the ear, and then we'll talk about how the eye works in conjunction with the brain. So on the top of page 126, those external structures on the outside of the eye include eyelids, which are lined with moist mucous membrane on the insides to help lubricate the surface of your eye. There are also glands in between your eyelids along the edges called tarsal glands, and those tarsal glands secrete an oily secretion that keeps your eyelids from sticking together. I know you've woken up in the morning at some point and had that crusty sleep in your eye. That is excess secretion from those tarsal glands. So if you've got allergies or pink eye, or maybe if you've got a cold, those are all reasons to have excess tarsal gland secretions. There is a blank there for you to fill in. It says, recall which muscle opens and closes your eye. Good. Orbicularis oculi. Good. So orbicularis oculi opens and closes your eye. We also have eyelashes that help prevent foreign materials from making their way into our eyes. And the name of the mucous membrane that covers the eye surface is the conjunctiva. So it's a moist mucous membrane. It's meant to protect the eye. And of course, people who have conjunctivitis have an inflammation of the conjunctiva. A lot of things can cause conjunctivitis. Everything from having a cold to allergies to being outside on a windy day or being exposed to maybe smoke in the air or dust in the air. So a lot of things can cause it. If it's viral or bacterial in nature, it is contagious. But if it's simply caused by allergies or smoke in the air, then it wouldn't be contagious in those circumstances. Let's talk about the tear situation. We've got something called a lacrimal apparatus. It is found on the lateral sides of your eye. And the job of that lacrimal apparatus is to secrete tears that drift from the lateral side of your eye toward the medial side of your eye. So the lacrimal gland is the gland that sits there on each corner of your eye, out here toward the edge of your eyebrows, and those tears drift across to the medial side at your nose. So the whole point here is to wash debris, bacteria, dust across your eye and flush it down into the tear ducts that sit here on either side of your nose and those lacrimal bones. Okay, so just to kind of tie things together, since we're talking about lacrimal glands, if we touch a dirty doorknob and then later on we rub our eyes, you've now taken whatever's on the doorknob and you've rubbed it into your eyes. Now your tear glands are going to flush those bacteria or viruses or whatever across your eye. It's going to be gone into one of these little ducts here, these lacrimal ducts by the medial portion of your eye, and then notice it flushes down into your nose. So this is a great way to transmit colds. You know, this is why we're, of course, told to wash our hands so often. But that's one transmission method, is to get the stuff into your eyes. It flushes into your sinuses next. From your sinuses, it will travel down into your nasal cavity, your pharynx or throat region, and it can become a sore throat. It can become a lung issue, and it can, of course, drift on further down into your lungs, into your bronchial passageways. So kind of an interesting concept to think that your eyes are ultimately linked to the innards of your lungs through this one continuous pathway back in there. Let's see, in terms of external eye muscles, we have a set of six for each eye. How many rectus muscles do we have?
Four.
Good. And how many oblique muscles? We got two. So the rectus muscles move the eye up, down, left, and right, and the oblique muscles do fine-tuned movement. So we're not going to go into detail as to what each muscle is responsible for doing, but you'll notice that they are pretty much named and do the same thing. For instance, the lateral rectus eye muscle moves the eye laterally, the medial one moves the eye medially, and so forth. So it makes sense when you think about what each of those rectus muscles will do. So in terms of external structures around the eye, that's pretty much it. What I'd like to do now is turn your attention toward a tour into the layers of the eye. Okay, so do you have any questions so far before we go into those tunics or layers? So what is the most superficial tunic on the eye?
Fibrous,
good. The middle layer is called a vascular tunic, and the deepest of the three is called a neural tunic. Tunic means layer. So we're going to detail what's in each of these layers. We're going to start first of all with that fibrous tunic on the outside surface. The fibrous tunic includes two portions, a tough outer portion called the sclera, and also a clear portion called the cornea. So what color is the sclera? White, yeah, that's the white portion of the eye. It is made of a tough connective tissue, and that is meant to protect the outer portion of the eye. So we often consider it to be the whites of the eye. It is also the point at which those intrinsic or extrinsic rather eye muscles insert on the eye surface. So you really can't see those because they sit behind the point where your eye emerges from the eye socket. The cornea, you'll notice, is a transparent portion that covers over the iris and the pupil. It has to be transparent for you to see through it. Interesting thing about that cornea, it is pretty much avascular. What does that mean about it? Yeah, no blood supply, right. So why do you think it is a great candidate for transplants? Right, not a lot of bleeding. And since there's not a lot of blood into that area, there's also a low risk for rejection. So we can do cornea transplants and pretty much have a risk-free surgery there because of such a low risk of rejection of that organ. So cornea is interesting. It's one of the few parts of our bodies that are pretty much avascular. All right, so let's now talk about the middle layer, which is known as the vascular tunic. The vascular tunic implies blood vessels. Vascular, of course, means blood vessels. There is a great blood supply to the middle layer that we call the vascular tunic. And you'll notice in this region we have an iris, ciliary bodies, and choroid. So which of these three makes up the colorful portion that we see when we look at our eyes?
Iris.
Iris, good. And the opening inside the iris is known as? Pupil, good. What is the function of that pupil?
Let
light in. So if it dilates, that means it enlarges in size and more light can pass into your eye. Under dim conditions, we would expect to have those pupils dilate. Under bright light conditions, however, we would expect to see that pupil constrict and limit the amount of light hitting the retina at the back of the eye. So in this picture, you can see the iris is right here in front of the lens, and the ciliary bodies sit right next to the iris. In fact, they're somewhat behind the iris. Those ciliary bodies are linked up to the lens by way of some little ligaments, And those ciliary bodies help the lens to change shape. You may notice it when you look at something close up, and then you look at something far away, and then back close up again. There's a split second there where you have to refocus on what you're looking at. Those lens, you know, that lens which is focusing your light on the back of the eye, actually has to reposition its shape every time you change focal distance. The ciliary bodies and these little ligaments right there are actually helping to change the lens's shape. The older we get, the more time it takes in changing that focal distance. So that's why people who, you know, head into their late 30s and early 40s then require reading glasses when they may never have needed them before. So the lens is going to be changed by those ciliary bodies and the ligaments that anchor them. Let me give you an example of how this actually works. Think about a trampoline. Okay, trampoline has a frame. It has the bouncy part in the middle. And then there's usually some type of spring or wire that anchors the bouncy part to the frame, right? So the bouncy part in the middle is like your lens, and the frame is the rest of the eye with those ciliary bodies. So those ciliary bodies are kind of like the springs that anchor your trampoline to its frame. So when you bounce, they keep that, you know, that lens or that trampoline in place and allow it to change shape. So that's kind of the concept that we're looking at here with those ciliary bodies. The choroid is actually a layer that's in this picture, yellow. I hope you can see that. It goes all the way around the back of the eye, and that choroid is rich with blood vessels that help to nourish the underlying retina. In this picture, the red layer going all the way around, that is the retina. That is the real interest here that we're going for. That retina is where we process or capture visual imagery. Okay. Any questions on the vascular tunic? Okay, so which one of these irises contains a pupil that is dilated? Dilated, yeah, the one on the right and constricted here on the left. So which one of these would be in, say, bright light conditions? The one on the left, yeah. Interesting thing to note here, which one of these eyes might be under sympathetic control? The right one, yeah. So the sympathetic nervous system dilates your pupils so you can take in more light and more about what's going on around you. I had a high school teacher that taught us about sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. This has been a million years ago, but it stuck with me because he said if you were interested in somebody, your sympathetic nervous system was in control and your pupils dilated. Let me tell you, no one made eye contact the rest of the semester for fear of that, you know? No one wanted to have those pupils dilated. Drugs can also do it. Certain medications can dilate the pupils. Things like cocaine or anything that speeds up the nervous system is going to cause those pupils to dilate. So I even had a student a few years ago. She had been wearing contacts. She had put in some eye drops. Under one eye, it dilated, and under the other eye, it constricted. And she was an LPN going for her RN degree at the time, and she knew that there was something wrong. And so it turned out, fortunately, that it was just simply a case of having put in eye drops and then slapping those contact lens right over the top. It didn't have a chance to, like, dilute and dissipate throughout her eye. So kind of an interesting scenario there. But I do want to mention that if one eye is dilated and one eye is constricted, there is possibly something else going on further back in the brain. That could be a warning sign there. This one is under parasympathetic control. During parasympathetic rest and digest, our pupils constrict because they're not really needing to take in more about our environment. Okay, so in this picture, you kind of get a feel for the trampoline, right? There's the part that you bounce on, that's the lens, and there's the frame with the ciliary bodies, and so those ciliary bodies do help to anchor and let that lens change shape. It should be flexible. So now we're ready to talk about the neural layer. Neural implies what? Yeah, nerves. So we had a tough outer fibrous tunic. We had a middle region with a lot of blood supply. And now we have an inner layer to the eye called a neural layer. This is full of nerves. So there are two layers to the retina that form your neural layer. We have a pigmented layer, which is a thin outer layer, and we have an inner layer called the neural layer. Boy, that's confusing. You have a neural tunic, and the neural tunic has a pigmented layer and a neural layer. Okay, so kind of play on words there. So I wanted to show you this picture. It's a pretty fancy picture. We're looking at the neural tunic at the back of the eye, and this, of course, is the retina. When light comes into the eye, it passes through the opening in your pupil, it travels through your lens, and ultimately it gets focused on the back of your eye on a specific portion of your retina. So from the bottom of the picture here, notice here comes the light. The light travels through a set of cells called bipolar cells. These are just a type of neuron. We then pass through a layer of cells that are either rods or cones, and then we hit back here a very thin layer of pigmented cells. The whole purpose of those pigmented cells is to help capture the light. If they were not there, the light would basically hit the back wall and then bounce right back out of your eye. So when you're taking a picture and somebody uses a flash, that flash is actually doing just that. It is not captured by the pigmented layer, and it's reflected right back out of the eye. So the goal here is to capture as much light as possible and then send it back into the brain for processing. Likewise, really bright lights overwhelm that pigmented layer, and you're not able to see when you're exposed to a really bright light. So we've got to have the right amount of light to be able to focus and see. Okay, so I do want to mention in this previous picture a couple of parts of the retina that are very important. You're looking at a snapshot of the retina, and you can actually see the blood vessel shining through from the underlying tunic. What layer or tunic is deep to the retina? Vascular, good. So you're actually getting a snapshot of those vascular layer behind the retina as well. So they're pointing out a little yellow spot right there called the fovea, and it's also known as the fovea centralis. So in plain English, what is the fovea important for? Let me help you out. It's on the very bottom of page 127.
Sharp vision,
yeah, that's it. So it is called the focal point. It is the place where the sharpest vision results. Okay, and if you read along there, it says it is sitting in the middle of something called the macula lutea or lutea. That technically translates to yellow spot. Boy, this was high tech when they did the eye, right? Just call that their yellow spot.
You know? Yeah.
Everything else has a fancy name, but okay, yellow spot, we'll go with it. Okay, so the fovea is a focal point of sharpest vision. It sits in a yellow spot called the macula, and that macula is going to be the place where we have the sharpest amount of color vision. So with the lights on, daytime, we can see really well. We've got color vision. But in dim light or at the nighttime where we have very low light levels, we actually don't see very well because we don't have a lot of rods in that fovea. In fact, there's no rods in the fovea. There's only cones there for color and daytime vision. Okay, just want to give you perspective. Right next to your fovea is an optic nerve, that bright yellow spot there, not to be confused with the macula lutea. That optic nerve is where vision is carried back into the brain. So just wanted to show you that they're not actually sitting on top of one another. They're sitting somewhat side by side. Fovea is over here, and we ultimately send our visual information down that optic nerve and back into the brain. All right, so how about questions so far on the three tunics of the eye? So let's talk about rods and cones. They're over on the top of page 128. All right, so the rods and cones are special photoreceptor cells. That means they are light sensitive. They are found in the retina of your eye. You'll notice the rods are the most common type of photoreceptor cell we have, and they're also common in our peripheral vision. So when something moves out of a corner of your eye and you catch that motion, those are the rods detecting that information. You know, some animals only can see you if you move. You know, if you've seen the movies, they'll say, stand real still. They can't see you unless you move. And that's how we are. If you stand really still and camouflage yourself against the background, then we can't see you because we're looking for motion in our peripheral vision. So we're one of those animals that actually needs somebody to move to be able to detect that you're there. So rods are in the peripheral vision and cones are in our central vision, our focal point. Notice the rods also detect black and white images. So rods are not there for color vision. They are there simply for motion and to detect black and white vision, outlines, shadows, movement. You'll notice that night blindness actually comes from a lack of vitamin A that causes our rods to work improperly. So people who have an honest-to-goodness vitamin A deficiency may have difficulty seeing at night. I don't know about you, but I hate driving at night. Yet somebody with their bright headlights behind you, especially these newfangled ones. You know, I feel like I'm sunk down in my car with the mirror turned up so that it doesn't shine in my face, and I don't want the side ones to hit me either. So people probably think, what's driving that, a toad? You know, they see you sunk down in your car. But in fact, it's myopia or nearsightedness that gives a lot of us trouble. So if I'm nearsighted, if you're nearsighted, that may in fact be the issue. It is rare for someone to have night blindness, honest to goodness vitamin A night blindness, because vitamin A is a rare deficiency in the first place. So if you hate night driving, it's quite likely a simple case of nearsightedness. You prefer to see up close and not far away. So those shiny bright lights can really give us trouble. So interesting thing to try, when you're out at night the next time on a really dark, clear night, if you are somewhere away from the lights of the city or the glow of a mall or any of those orange lights that distort our night vision, take a look up at the sky and pick out a really bright star. If you focus on that bright star at night where it's very dark, you're not going to see it very well if you look directly at it. Why not? Okay, so where are your rods? Are they in your focal point?
Peripheral.
Yeah. They are not in your focal point. They are not in your fovea. So if you stare directly at that bright star in the very dark of night, you're not going to see it very well. But if you're looking at this star here and you shift your vision over here, your peripheral vision has rods, and that star will suddenly show up very bright in your peripheral vision. It is a really cool trick to try on a dark night where there's a lot of bright stars in the sky. So keep in mind, rods are not in your fovea, they're in your peripheral vision, so look away from the bright spot to be able to see those stars. Let's talk about cones. Cones are colorful, C for C, okay? Cones detect colors, and they are in your fovea or your focal point. Okay, so they respond to light, and they light up in various colors or various combinations. They detect things like blue, reds, and greens. And the order that they light up in, or the combination they light up in, is what gives us the variety of colors that we see. So, you know, they say certain animals like dogs can only see in black and white. If that is in fact true, what must they be lacking in their retinas? Cones. Yeah, they would be lacking some cones. So if they can examine, say, a dog's retina and find cones there, then in fact they must be able to see some color. So that's how they say, you know, certain animals see certain colors or don't see color at all. It's they're basing that on the presence of rods or cones. Let's talk about color blindness for just a moment. Color blindness is actually a genetic condition that's passed from parents to offspring, and it's more common in males than in females. The reason it's more common in males is because it only takes one faulty gene to come from mom, but for females to have color blindness, it takes a faulty gene from both mom and dad. So, give you a moment here to take a look. Let me hit the lights, you might be able to see it better. you see all those okay?
Not the one at the left on the bottom.
It is hard. It is, in fact, an
E. An L.
Yeah, an L, and there's also parts of an E. Yeah. Looks like an 18 right there.
Yeah, what's on the bottom right? 12 or 17.
I think it's a 17. I don't know. I have to read up on that. That's
it's
interesting.
It's brand new technology, but he's a gardener, so you know he does flowers. They actually had his birthday gathering in the backyard with his flowers all around him, and he opens it and they're telling him, he's like, really? And he puts them on for like a second like this, and he takes them all and starts bawling.
Wow.
He tries to do it again, and he just starts bawling.
Oh, wow.
It's brand new technology.
I had not heard of theirs. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I had them like last year, and they like they did balloons for him, and he saw the balloons and all different colors and like started bawling at them.
That's cool.
Yeah, that would be fascinating because I guess you're seeing in black and white, and to have all that color has got to be fantastic.
I wonder how it works because there was nothing attached to his head or anything. It just looks like sunglasses.
I'll have to read on that and see what it manipulates.
I haven't read on. I haven't had a chance to yet.
Well, thanks for telling me. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Y'all see all the numbers and letters here? I think these are all numbers. Have a hard time with any of these? Bottom two?
Yeah.
So the most common type of color blindness is actually a red-green color blindness, but there's in fact blue-yellow color blindness and other forms that are more rare. So, you know, people who don't see those colors in fact see shades of gray or black. So, you know, that makes it very difficult for operating in life if you're relying upon those colors. Stoplights, right?
Because
right.
He's colorblind, and he always come out and be like, does this look okay? Because I can't really tell if these colors match. Because, I mean, he couldn't see.
I've heard that having somebody lay out the clothes. Yeah. That'd be very difficult. Okay, so what is basically sent back to your retina is, in fact, an upside pollen, love it.
Mm-hmm.
Upside down and reversed image. And very early on after you're born, your brain starts receiving these images and learns to flip them upright. So our brains should learn to reprocess the image in a proper method. But interesting to note that what comes into your eye is in fact upside down and reversed from what you actually interpret and see. So kind of cool there.
Wait a minute.
What's that?
So like you, or just pictures?
Everything you see is upside down and reversed on your retina. And then your brain and the pathways, it flips it back upright again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we're upside down.
Everything's upside down on the retina.
Well, the ones that have dyslexia, they have to remember to flip. I have children with dyslexia, and their dad has full mirror dyslexia, so his images don't flip.
Oh, wow.
He has a bachelor's degree in computer engineering, but struggles because all of the codes and stuff are numbers,
oh, wow,
letters, and he'll sit there on the simplest thing, can't flip it because he can't remember to sit there and flip that number or flip that image.
Wow.
So dyslexia is more common in girls. His aunt had it. He had it. They found it when he was in third grade. My daughter has it, and my son has part of it. He's not quite as bad as she is, but she will sit there and struggle because she can't remember to flip herself.
That's got to be a constant thing to work with all
it
the
is.
Time. Wow.
And it's a struggle because they struggle in math and English.
With those letters and numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. Too bad we can't get glasses to help with that.
He does have glasses, and it does help some, but
we're like a special type that somehow flips it for them. Yeah. But he doesn't actually his vision is not upside down or backwards. It's just those numbers and letters, the symbols are reversed. Wow. If you want to try the blind spot test, you actually have to put some kind of spot, like a star and a dot on a piece of paper, and you can hold them about arm's length away from your face and close one of your eyes. When you focus on the other spot, like if you pick this focus on that round dot on the right, as you move the paper closer to your face, the star will actually disappear. So you wonder what in the world happened. You knew it was on the piece of paper. You have found a portion of your optic nerve that has no cones. So the vision that's processed by a single eye can be located, or you know, actually detected by you by looking at something like this and moving it closer to your face. So about 6 to 8 inches from your face, you'll find your blind spot. But you know what? If you've got two functional eyes, you're never ever going to notice your blind spot because the vision fields overlap. So you never actually see your blind spot unless you close one of your eyes and do some practice like this. Kind of the same concept as driving in your car. You know, there's a certain field back there that you can't really see. So it's the same issue there. There's just not a field of vision in your optic nerve that has cones in it for each eye. So one eye shut, you see the blind spot. Okay, so the next thing there on your worksheet is cavities and chambers of the eye. You'll notice that we have an anterior cavity and a posterior cavity. You'll want to make note, what separates those two cavities? The lens. Yeah, the lens separates the two cavities, and the chambers are separated by the iris. Okay, so you want to make a note there. The two cavities, anterior and posterior, are separated by the lens. And within the anterior cavity, we have two chambers that are separated by the iris. So each of these chambers and these cavities contains a type of jelly-like fluid. In the anterior cavity, we have a fluid called the aqueous humor. So I keep it alphabetically straight. A comes before V. The anterior cavity contains an aqueous humor. The posterior cavity contains a vitreous humor. So the anterior cavity's aqueous humor circulates throughout the anterior portion of your eye. If you've ever had a glaucoma test done where they puff air onto the surface of your eye to detect pressure, they're looking to see that aqueous humor has not built up so much pressure that it can cause blindness by damaging your cornea. So that aqueous humor should circulate and drain throughout your anterior cavity. That is the region in front of your lens, okay? So specifically, if you were to look inside the anterior cavity, the front portion in front of the iris is anterior chamber, and the portion between the iris and the lens, that's a very small amount of space, that's technically the posterior chamber. But aqueous humor circulates throughout that entire area, and that's what they're looking for when they detect glaucoma, to make sure there's not too much pressure in that aqueous fluid that's traveling through the anterior cavity. Posterior cavity is behind the lens. This big space back here contains a jelly-like fluid that we call vitreous humor. We sometimes do eyeball dissections in lab. We have sheep eyes and cow eyes that we cut open. You know, sometimes when we're not running out of time, we have an opportunity to pull those out and look at them. If you've ever seen a saline breast implant, it looks like a little clear sack of fluid. That is exactly what the vitreous humor looks like. It is just a little sack of jelly-like fluid, and light that passes through it on the way to the back of the eye actually travels through that vitreous humor. Okay, let's talk about the lens. So it is next on our page there. This lens is important for refracting or bending light. When you start off life as a kid, that lens is very clear, very transparent. And the older we get, the more cloudy that lens becomes. By the time people are in their 60s, 70s, and beyond, they oftentimes have to have that lens replaced because of what? Cataracts, yeah, because of cataracts. So cataracts can make it very difficult to see. Of course, it can cloud up the eye and look something like this. So that's a pretty far gone set of cataracts there. So the whole issue with the lens is it helps to focus light on the back of the eye. We want to focus that light on the fovea. The fovea centralis is the focal point. What type of photoreceptor cells does it house? Cones or rods? Cones. Okay, so the whole point here of the lens is to help focus your vision on your fovea centralis. That's your focal point. And that focal point contains cones only. That's your sharpest area of color vision. I do want to mention an issue we often run into. It's called an astigmatism. So if you're diagnosed with an astigmatism, then you'll notice there, hey, you're just early. I think we probably all have. So an astigmatism is a misshapen cornea. And unfortunately, that can create multiple focal points in the back of your eye. So what people with astigmatisms often see are blurred vision. So nonetheless, an astigmatism is not necessarily your lens's fault, but the lens is not helping the matter because it can't really focus all that vision onto one spot. So those with an astigmatism often wear lens contacts or something to help correct that set of focal points. Otherwise, we're left with blurry vision and a headache, double focal points. Okay, so down there near the bottom of your page, let's talk about the pathway of information into your eye. So a lot of this is familiar. We've talked about it recently with the brain. What your eye picks up is focused on the backside at the retina. So let's talk about how we get that vision on the backside there. Let's start here with the cornea. We're going to let light pass through the cornea. It will travel through an anterior cavity that contains a type of fluid called the aqueous humor. From there, the light travels through an opening called the pupil. That pupil sits inside the iris. And now the light is refracted or bent by the lens. The lens then sends the light through the back part of your eye, again through another set of fluids called the vitreous humor. What cavity houses the vitreous humor?
Posterior,
good. So from that point, we should be focusing our light back there on the back part of your retina in a focal point known as what? Yeah, fovea centralis, good. So the fovea is going to pick up on that information, and now we're going to send that information down the optic nerve. You'll notice the optic nerve leaves the eye. It does contain a blind spot where there are no cones for processing vision. So of course, if you've got two functional eyes, you'll never notice that blind spot. At the top of the picture there, let's travel with those optic nerves from the backs of the eyes. They will make an X and cross here at an area called the optic chiasma. So where they cross like an X is called the optic chiasma. From there, we are now officially part of the central nervous system, and we're going to change the name from optic nerve to optic tract. The word tract implies a collection of nerves in the CNS. So you'll notice that each eye sends information along its same pathway, and also information crosses over and travels down the opposite hemisphere. We're going to make our next stop at a processing center or a relay station here. This is the thalamus. So what is the job of the thalamus?
Relay
sensory info. So the thalamus says, vision goes to which lobe?
Occipital.
Good. So you'll notice these fibers that travel along each side of the brain here are what type of fibers? Association. Good. So we let this information travel through the thalamus on back to the back part of the brain, and once we arrive in the occipital lobe, we arrive first at the primary visual cortex. What happens there? It's where you can see. Good. And then where do you process that visual information next?
Association
area. Good. So we have to make our way all the way back there to that association area for us to be able to interpret and understand. So in fact, both eyes are going to have information travel along their respective hemispheres and also cross and go to the opposite hemisphere. So the occipital lobe actually gets information from both your right and left eye simultaneously. Okay, so how about questions so far on this page?
We need to know that pathway, don't we?
I would know that pathway. Yeah, that's going to be on the final. Yeah. What we just went through, which is on the bottom of page 128, this has extra info that you don't need.
So no 1 and 2?
No 1 and 2, because 1 is just through the eye, and the second pathway is from the eye to the brain, so it's two pathways there. Okay, so the first part is just the eye, the second part to the brain. So over on page 129, just a little bit left to finish up here on the eye, the job of the eye is to bend or focus the light on the back of the retina. The term refraction means to bend that light, and there's a couple of parts of your eye that actually do this job. One part of the eye is the cornea, and the other part of the eye is the lens, and both of those refract and bend light so it can be focused on the focal point, otherwise known as your fovea centralis. So when we're thinking about being able to see properly, sometimes we can see without glasses, sometimes we need those glasses or contacts to refract the light properly for us. So I'd like to talk to you about some issues with accommodation. So since the lens is acting as a accommodating feature of your eye and helping to refract the light on the back, if your lens and your eyeball is not focusing that light properly, then we need, of course, help. So a perfectly shaped eye is an emmetropic eye. That's the ideal situation. But if you have an eyeball that is too short, we call that a myopic eye. So you'll note, too long, that's a myopic eye. So you'll notice that the focal point actually extends not to the retina, but it stops somewhat short of actually ever reaching the retina. So in this case, people can't see far away, but they can see up close. So in the case of a myopic person, a lens that helps to extend that focal point to the back of the eye helps them to be able to see distance. Interesting, your eye is normally set for distance vision. So, you know, driving down the road, your eye is normally set for that faraway vision. Our eyes are not set for close-up vision. But what do? We work on our phones, our computers, our textbooks. We read constantly. So we are actually forcing our eyes to work with close vision instead of what they're set for, which is distance vision. Okay, so short eyeballs are hyperopic. This means you can't see close up, but you can see far away. And yet again, you have a accommodation here with lens to help move that focal point so you can still see. The good news is, if you are myopic and have a long eyeball, your eyeball will age and shrink, so you will have less of a need for correction for distance as you get older. But the unfortunate thing is, you may then pick up a need for bifocals or reading glasses because our lens becomes less elastic and flexible with age. So you can't win, right? So old eyes are called presbyopia, and this means that the eyeball shrinks with age. That lens becomes less elastic and less able to accommodate for changes in distance. All right, so if you need to review any of that on Monday, we can definitely go back and do it. Monday we're going to hit the ear, and then we'll have time for review next Wednesday. Y'all have a good weekend.